Many years ago, I think Dale was a member of this group, and probably Taylor and Ed St. Clair and I think they were all of
us.
Huh?
Yeah. It was the mid-60s mafiosi. And for reasons that are now obscure, I suggested that the seminar read the piece that I contributed to the Polanyi Intellectual Hope Body. And Bruce Haddock, who I believe is not here tonight.
No, he's here?
Hey.
Late.
Well, that's right. I'm delighted to see that you have been separated from your cigar. But Bruce Haddock came to class and with characteristic restraint and gentility said, I just had no idea what in the hell was going on in this piece. And then suddenly I started imagining listening to you read it. And all of a sudden, it began to make sense. Now, that's exactly what you should expect. Robert Penn Warren made the observation that poetry requires a mallet. That, in other words, it's not to be read in your cubicle. It needs to be said. Well, if what I'm claiming here has any legitimacy, then it absolutely must be the case that you can understand what's going on here better when you see me doing it than you can by reading the books, even though I make a strenuous effort to reproduce that state of affairs subject to the limitations of print. So, it seems to me that the academic world is imprisoned in an essentially discarnate world of teachers' notes and students' notes, usually with a barrier, physical barrier, separating the one from the other, which both students and teachers are glad to have, lest they should fall upon one another. Now, this is all by way of saying, and I don't mean to sound facetious about this, that Plato understood perfectly well the role that eros plays in intellection. And if eros plays a role there, then a Platonic dialogue with living participants is better than a Platonic dialogue read in translation from the Greek. And that's because the reality that is brought into being by our exchanges of our words and gestures and movements and visual expressions and all the rest of it literally produce a world. So that you may say, well, it's a very unstable one, but when you walk out of this room tonight, you will be carrying with you, for a certain length of time, a world that we together conjured up. And it is necessarily more real to each of us than could have been the case if I had simply gotten out a copy of a book of mine and read it aloud to you. So, if I might just add one self-serving observation about my own teaching experience, which, to put it mildly, met with extraordinarily equivocal responses from students. What I did was to limit the class to 25, and had I my choice, I would have limited it to 12, simply because it's easier to do that. And we read a single book, in this case, Anna Arendt's The Human Condition. This was an upper level undergraduate course
that I think the writer was originating modern problems. And when I say he read a book, he didn't read this book. He never got, in all of the 20 years or so that I used this, you never got to the end. We never even got beyond the middle. And the reason was that what was going on was a colloquy between Arndt's text and my interventions and the student's response. Now, the strangest and most inexplicable outcome of all of this, to me, was literally the last class I ever taught at Duke, was a special session designed for rising senior high school students. Half of the students were in this class, and half were regular Duke undergraduates. And the course was a summer school course, and these high school kids got college credit. This was obviously a recruiting tactic. Contributed absolutely nothing to the youth group of it, but not so good students this way. The last class I taught was on the subject interpretations of religion in the Western world, or something like that, Bob. You remember that course? And what I did was about a 5 or 6 week course, and we met for an hour and 45 minutes a day. And I gave them short things like Existentialism of the Humanism by Jean-Paul Sartre, or the first chapter of Language, Truth, and Logic, or Roy, the Future of an Illusion, and so on. Things that a reasonable student could be expected to read and appear in the seminar room, and I would think, what is this all about? What's going on here? And I don't exaggerate when I say that it almost brought me to a state of collapse because I could not get a rise out of these people. Neither the Duke undergraduates nor the high school students, who I expected to do something interesting. They all sat there, and I could look them in the eye and say, what do you think is going on when John Paul Sartre said so? And it was as if what I had said had had the effect upon their brains of radio waves or something. I was, to say the least, grateful that this was my last class at Duke. After the course was over, the students had gotten their final papers back, and they were all going downstairs together from the third floor, and the stairs were wide enough for us to walk to the abreast. And one of the students, with a little bunch around him, said, you know, this is absolutely the greatest course. And I was so floored, so left in such a state of catatonia by this observation, that I didn't have the presence of mind to say, why? And I have thought about that many times, and I really believe that in part, what they found interesting about this course was that, for good or ill, they saw intellect at work, even if they didn't feel that they were ready to enter into it. And that's what they thought was great. It was more entertaining even than something. Is that responsive to your query? I have a feeling you've got something really good to say on that, Cor, and I wish you'd do it.
Well, that put me in the sock. I think it's intriguing. I'm really glad you're here. Really glad. I think we need your presence this morning. And I guess I wonder if something about the structure of our way of discussing Bernie a part of this. Do we know all the precisely pick up in the way or but whatever. I'm glad you're here.
Well, thank you. And Marshall, I'm glad you're here to ask that question.
Yes.
Phil, I have another, only two this time. There was a part in there when you're talking about your retro tensions and your pro tensions, and I've enjoyed your tennis example, the use of the disattending, in which you say, you talk about the equipment that you have is how hazardous it is, and that you have that when the memory and the hope go, that is sort of, that's the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt a moment of sanity in my really wanting to believe in a Yahweh who can raise the dead,
mm-hmm.
and but some sort of eternal life. And so I wondered if you could tell me how far you can get me in your work with my task of believing there, God to raise the dead. Secondly, you talk about the conjuring up a world.
Yes.
And I know that it's my belief that you're not a constructivist. You know, you're not an objectivist. When I'm saying, well, what the heck does he mean by the conjuring up a world? It sounds very subjective and relative.
But look what you and I are doing right now. Have we not, between us, in the course of this conversation, conjured up a world? And was there anything subjective in the bad sense about that?
I'm ready to hear the one about the raising their dead.
That's a tougher one.
I'll let you know.
I'm not looking for the arrival. I'm saying how far. You seem to me you could get me somewhere where I could do better with it. And I'm not asking for the final.
Judgment.
I'm looking for an arrival plan.
You don't know what a relief that is to hear. Am I to understand that what you want some response from me on is how my stated embrace of Taoism translates into some of the familiar theological doctrines of Christianity? Is that what you're after?
Not exactly. And in fact, I confess that I do not. I should know the meaning of this term, the transubstantiation. I forgot what that means.
It means that the wine and the bread that are blessed by the priest in the celebration of the Eucharist really become the blood and the body of Christ.
Okay. Thank you. What I'm asking for is, maybe I can answer my own question. In other words, it seems like you have a one of your endpoints, possibly the supreme endpoint in your blind meditation, is the reliance on the faithfulness of God. So where I could take myself with that is I'm saying, okay, you know, I can try the best I can to respond to my calling and go through the protensions and the retrotensions and the hope and the memory, and then eventually I have to depend on the faithfulness of God.
Mm-hmm. You don't have to.
Well, not have to, but I mean, that's true.
It is nowhere written that you have to.
That's true. But I mean, I can get that. That makes sense to me.
Okay.
That after, like Pindar said, I am hopeful, but God has the final word.
Right.
So, if that's your theology in that book, as far as my question goes, then I'm saying, okay, well, that's as far as I've got.
That's it.
Okay.
You got it.
Thank you.
You intend it.
Thank you.
Bill, come at it another way. You made a comment about how does your thought then translate into commentary on traditional and Christian theological points? You could really come at it the other way around. That is, how has your long inquiry informed by certain Christian theological points informed the position that you now have and what has guided you in your search for a sense of bedrock. And the two things that immediately come to mind for me are the sense of incarnation and the sense of logos. And it seemed that with your notion of mind-body, that, well, I'll overstate it, that only from a Christian, led in through a Christian point of view with the radical sense of incarnation, could you ever have arrived at such a radical notion of mind-body in the first place.
Absolutely. So
then, you know, as that turns back to a, it's not looking then disinterestedly at incarnation, but has arrived. Very much could be said of the same thing of logos, not in the Greek sense, the static logos in a sense, but the sense of speech and a convivial order and so on. But to come back to his point, when I think of Christianity, in terms of beliefs, the three points I always come up with are incarnation, logos, and resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
So then it was to come back and puzzle over the same thing, not his question of how does your thought apply to the notion of resurrection, but really the other way around. Is there any sense of resurrection at play in the long project that you have been on? In the same sense in which incarnation and logos, and asking it only because, rightly or wrongly, those are the three things I always come up with in Christianity.
Yes, and I think that they are a good three things to come up with, and I like very much everything that you said, including the suggestion that had I not been an incarnationist deep down in my bone, and if I had not believed in the logos deep down in my bones, I never could have come to the kind of appreciation of my own mind-bodily existence that I've tried to articulate. The notion of resurrection has not surfaced in what I have had to say, I suppose simply because, in a sense, it's presupposed in what I've said. Now, let me explain. Do I believe in the resurrection of the body? And the answer is yes. If you ask me to elaborate on what that means, that's a theological question that has a long and complicated history into which I am not only not competent to enter, but am uneasy of entering into at just this point in connection with your question. But I take the belief in the resurrection of the body to be an affirmation about the nature of our being in the world, that we are not discarnate spirits, and we will not once again be discarnate spirits when, at our death, that spirit leaves the body. In other words, to put it much too crudely, I would say that belief in the resurrection of the body is an affirmation about the nature of what it is for me to be a son of God, and that is to be mind and body son of God, so that this scar on my wrist, surreptitiously inflicted when I was messing with a Chinese carpenter's sharp chisel and walked several miles with blood running down on the ground. I make that all very vivid for you because that is right there on my body, and that's involved in the groaning and traveling of creation so far as it concerns me in my relationship vis-a-vis the Almighty. It's anything less than that is, in my view, a denial of the first two points that he used to characterize the nature of what Christianity is for you.
And just to come back one last thing about it, I also come back to the point that you made about
your earlier work and mm-hmm. the discovery that you make in the essays. Well, I guess are out.
They are. Yes, the bad news is out. Yeah, I mean, I have, you see, one of the things that Nick Hoyt said Steins did was to hand me all this stuff and make me read it to be sure that I really was saying what they thought I was saying, and they discovered many places that I was talking utter nonsense. I mean, even I recognized it as such. But I said, by golly, this was a portent of what was to come for me.
I want to go back to what you were talking about just before, what you were talking about, conjuring up the world. That may be even more difficult for us than what we've just been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we've just been talking about is religion. When you talk about conjuring up the world, we start getting nervous.
Yes.
As you just, with your example, so this, if you're not talking about something mysterious.
It's commonplace.
And we maybe tend to overlook it for that reason. The two examples that sort of have ordinary kinds of examples that I think of, that so if you start paying attention, you'll notice kinds of things too, are if you'd ever in newspapers read a record of a conversation among either an interview, a reporter, interviewee, or a conversation among those people, if you read that, and you say, if you manage to read it, it's probably done.
Mm-hmm.
You say, there must be more to it.
Yeah.
Whereas if you had been there, there was more to it. The same thing can happen if you have heard someone speak and give a lecture, and then go back and transcribe a tape. You find something different in the transcription of that tape than was there in what you heard. So those are just ordinary, everyday kinds of things that is going to confirm what you were saying.
Yes, they do indeed.
Not something mysterious at all.
Not anything mysterious in the least. And if there is a two of you were to fall into conversation as you started heading for your hotel room for the night, and were in a sense recapitulating what went on in there tonight, you might diverge very sharply from one another as to what had gone on in there. But this is not problematic. This is just another conversation taking place. And if there is the need to adjudicate among the alternative interpretations of what happens, then we will set about doing that. The probability is there will be no need to adjudicate among them. I want to say that reality is the sum of all of these realities that come into being among us this way. And if you say, oh dear, that's idealism. This is one of the swords that hangs over my head all the time, or used to. I cut the damn thing down and stashed it in the corner. But this is a natural reaction, and Ron Hall was always jumping on me every time I would send him something, threatening me because I was being an idealist, and I always reported that idealism is a danger only to people for whom a distinction between the ideal and the real is real. And to me, in the context of what I'm arguing, they cut no ice. Just as you know, one of the favorite debates among some of the people that read or half read Wittgenstein is, was he a linguistic behaviorist or not? And if one thing is obvious about Wittgenstein, he would probably not be able to contain himself, since he was not an easy person, shall we say. He would say that the distinction between behaviorism and something else doesn't exist, because it supposes that there is a distinction between the mental and the physical. Now, this is in our bones, and so I'm not at all suggesting that it's possible for me to come, you know, swaggering in here talking about a Copernican revolution and have everybody go home a Copernican. On the contrary, I hope only to make your consciences slightly uneasy so that you'll sit down and say, now wait just a minute. Am I backsliding, and if so, how?
All of what Aramis said is true, and what you're saying is true too, that the ordinary and the commonplace happen, and there is wonderment in it. But one of the problems is, what do we do when we stop thinking about the ordinary and the commonplace? Some weekends ago, I was over at Ron's house, and we were about Ron was fixing a couple of martinis. He didn't have any olives, and his neighbor said, "I've got a bottle of olives in my refrigerator, but they are cut up for salad. Would they be all right?" And Ron said, and I'm sure you will appreciate this, Ron said, "Yeah, they'll be fine."
Yeah.
Okay, now there's a stripping of gears in the world that has been conjured up there.
Mm-hmm.
There is a contradiction in the world that has been conjured up there. And isn't one of the things that your work is calling upon your readers to do is to attend not simply to the wonderment of the ordinary, but also to the contradictions that we live in not being able to think well about the ordinary?
Yes, that, but there's also the further thing. I like the story about Ron and the olives. And most of us read body language with great skill, and we would immediately recognize anyone saying, yes, they would do just fine. Dealing with a state of conflict of some sort. But what I would want to add to all of this is that the marvel is that without taking thought, we render coherent in, how shall I put it, actual living, what for thought could only be construed as radical incoherence, just as there would be radical incoherence between what Ron was doing with his head and what he was doing with his mouth. You see what I mean? In other words, let's take a, you like these theological things, and
I don't.
I know you don't. I used to think that I was a lapsed Episcopalian until I couldn't figure out what it would mean to be a lapsed.
Redundant.
Right, those feel like.
No, but what I was going. Now you made me forget what I mean.
You used to think you were a lot of
coherence.
No. Coherence, yes. Coherence. Okay. Now, if I only knew what I was going to say about that. Wait just a minute. It'll come to me.
LAD to figure out how those, how he understood what he meant when he said that's just fine?
Yeah. Yeah.
No,
it's a theoretical. We, in the course of celebrating the Holy Communion or morning prayer or whatnot, we recite the Nicene Creed or the Apostles' Creed. See, when they are participated in. So, you don't have to, and indeed you can't, render logically coherent the Apostles' Creed by taking it apart and examining the logic of each of its several claims. The Apostles' Creed is a complex entity that bears within it the Christian faith to the worshiping confessor, or, yes, confessor, Dale.
This is a question that I'm going to have to struggle to learn, but I can find it.
This is the kind of preface that can cause a man to tremble.
I'm going to answer. You just referred to the Apostles' Creed, something that does not make sense. Contemplated in the abstract.
Yeah.
Always approached in our full embodiment.
Yes.
I'd like to ask whether from your experience and revolution standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back and rereading Plato,
mm-hmm.
he makes more sense than the tradition of the
yes.
In contemplating that in such way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In other words, the Plato that weighs heavily upon us is the Plato that we have chosen to let weigh heavily upon us. Just as the same is true in the case of Descartes. Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I believe it or not, I go back and I read, not often, but I read Away in the Republic, and I said, God, you know, Plato really was a smart guy. He really had it. And as Phil Berkman will tell you, John Berkman, Thomas Aquinas was, too. Isn't that right, John? Are you ready to declare on that question?
Get my book.
Okay. Yes?
I'm Jim Wagner. I'm embarrassed to ask this question because I can't recall exactly how you put it in your book, in one of the books, but you were talking about worlds being called into being.
Yes.
Not just conceptually, not just by language, but either.
Yes.
That there's a different world called into being by Bach's preludes.
Yes.
And Chopin's tinkling over the abyss.
Yes. Yes. Fluttering over the abyss like a bird of bright plumage.
Right. My question is whether or not there's not around that issue a whole different vision than I've ever seen of aesthetic.
Yes.
Because you work very cleanly and clearly in ontology and in epistemology and pulling together or making those terms irrelevant. Really, in a
that's
way.
Right.
And in a way, aesthetics becomes irrelevant too. But there's a perspective for it. Would you comment on that a little bit?
Well, I believe that, first of all, let me endorse what you have imputed to me as, in fact, what I have said. And that I am dwelling in the world, which at the moment may include the sound of the washing machine chugging away in the laundry, the sound of passing cars, the sound of my mastiff pup snoring. All of these are elements of the world that I am then in, and when Glenn Gould is playing the Goldberg variations, that is a world that I dwell in. Now, if you wonder where I got all that, I have to, here I have to do honor to Glenn Hall's mentor. Here we go. In this sense, the most important single thing that I ever read in my life, and I must tell you that when I proudly presented my copy of Volume 1 of Either Or to a graduate student at Yale who was very senior and very conscious of his seniority and who was sort of the resident Kierkegaard scholar amongst graduate students, I proudly showed him my copy of Either Or on the steps of the Sterling Library at Yale, having just acquired it for $2, the hardback copy from the Princeton Press edition. And he said, oh, there's nothing in that that is of any importance whatsoever. And what I found in there was the immediate stages of the musical erotic. And I read and puzzled over that thing for perhaps 30 years. And there is a sense in which I learned more about how to talk about these things from author A, who is the pseudonymous author of this disquisition on music and architecture and painting, sculpture and opera and epic and so on. That's where I got all of that. And so for me to be listening to the music of Mozart while observing the Guernica mural of Picasso puts me in a different world from that in which I find myself when listening to the St. Matthew Passion in the Cathedral of Chartres. And I feel these things palpably. I feel that this music is a palpable limit to my being. Not only a limit, but a ground for it. I'm very charmed by what you just said about the possible, at least the necessity to revise, if not to abandon aesthetics as we have understood before, simply because I've never thought of that, and I think you're right. Aesthetics then becomes a Kierkegaardian category to be laid down alongside of ethical and ethico-religious. So you see, you spotted something that I had not spotted in, as such myself before, and that is that this Copernican revolution will do that to your Bach and your Masaccio.
Does anybody hope to see how the other side of the Copernican revolution is probably me? I've been listening to the and thinking about the theological illustration in the Nicene and the Apostles' Creed, and I understand you, and I understand you say that when you read this as embodied members of the body of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
If what otherwise appears from an objective standpoint is only little amount that come together. My problem is as a writer of this sort of stuff. And I could really do that helps me as a reader.
Mm-hmm.
but I'll swear I don't know what it says beneath the writer.
Mm-hmm.
How would a theologian who was on the other side of the revolution write any differently from one who was a pre-revolutionary? Let me comment here. We had a conversation at your house, I remember.
Yeah.
When we talked about writing with a pencil versus a word processor, and that occurred to me as the only answer that I, for the moment, can give. What does it mean to write theology in this revolutionary way?
In a perfectly real sense, Bob, it need entail no changes whatsoever in what you do. What it entails is a change in your sense of how this is authorized and vindicated. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I do, and I think I do, anyway. But I guess I'm not sure how revolutionary. You might say, very simply, you do it prayerfully.
Well, that's certainly true. But does it not make any difference to you as a theologian, for example, that the mind-body dualism simply has no cash value anymore?
Yes, definitely, and in other ways, but I still don't know quite how I make that work, that realization work, when I sit down with the pendulum.
Well, I don't know, because I would...
Other than that I would certainly not write in such a way as to, advocate it, nor would I interpret the say what I'm writing my document. Mankind, humankind, person. I would make it clearly. If you want to make clear, we must not speak in these prolific ways anymore. But it's much more than this, I think.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's get it away from what you're doing, which I don't have before me, and which, if you like, you can present to us, but absent that, we are talking rather abstractly. But let me just ask you this. How would the history of 19th and 20th century theology have been different if the problems, or if what was problematic for theologians in the 19th and 20th century, resulting from dualism, didn't exist, hadn't existed?
I can understand it. That point, I think.
So, for example, let's take Schleiermacher and Ritschl. Now, how would they have written differently if they had not been faced with the problematic of dualisms? Dualisms that, to be sure, were foisted upon them by Immanuel Kant.
I guess, but I understand, one can imagine from that perspective that actually they probably say that some 20th century theologians have attempted to do that. But I was thinking more. You're reflecting more on the what they have written, I think, than how they write.
Mm-hmm.
They're writing as non-dualistic persons.
Yeah.
You have been reflecting primarily on what the non-dualistic persons write, rather than on how they do it. It's the former dimension of it, and maybe I'm wrong in even asking about that. I'm expecting that there'll be some way in which being embodied would actually change the way.
It won't change. In other words, this is a better account, I would argue, of how you actually have written theology all your life than the account that you would give if I were to ask you to give it in terms of the tradition of philosophies that you and I both grew up in. See, I'm not showing you something that you haven't been practicing all your life. I'm trying to discover that what you've been practicing all your life is different from the way in which a second-order reflection on it interprets it.
There are some people who want to jump in, I think, on this.
Can I get an application?
Yeah.
Yeah. Over 25 years ago, when Harvey Alpher and I would walk into your class,
yes,
we would look forward to wonderfully long responses to questions, and the only question we would have among ourselves and often lay at that would be whether there would be one sentence in there, or it might be two in the course of the hour. Now, you see, that's changed part of it.
You mean?
Well, you've gotten a lot of sentences.
You mean I'm using more sentences or fewer?
Well, they're more serious than shorter.
Well, that's interesting. Somebody said to me the other day that I had never seen a semicolon that I didn't like.
I wondered whether that if there is a change in the way you write in that sense, if there are, from 25 years ago to now, the kind of form you use to convey your writing, if that invites by more sentences and shorter sentences, a different kind of response in the reader.
My writing is something over which I do not exert very much sovereignty. I simply am the creature of this thing. Now, I know that this sounds weird, but it isn't weird. It's true of you no less than it is of me. That, in other words, the text of what you write evokes from you an assent. But the reason that I go for extended dependent clauses within dependent clauses is that I am overwhelmed by the sense of the inadequacy of the medium of the printed word to convey what it is I'm trying to convey. And so what I try to do is to grab hold of the reader and hold on to him or her. And the way I do that is to keep them suffering from one dependent clause to the next.
He's succeeding
that. Bruce?
I want to ramble for just a minute, and the reason I was thinking really when first the question about resurrection was asked until Bob's question about the methodology or the how he writes the test, all that's gone on between those two strikes me as being really related. If you wanted to say that modern theology, insofar as say even a Schleiermacher up through the contemporary theologian, are actually creating are constructing some world in which we know well. And certainly it doesn't affect them, but it seems what's interesting to me about modern theology is that theologians do not simply do that. They also either for or at tell you the meaning of what they've done. The first 128 pages of the Christian faith, for instance, Schleiermacher, it tells you what he's going to do in terms of how. Or in other words, the kind of the world. He said, here's the world that I'm speaking in. And that world is not a world that, in fact, is created within a community of speaker and hearer. It's the world that Kant leads.
Right.
And on and on. And that's true of Tillich, and that's true in some sense of Bart. So in one sense, it seems to me that what you are talking about does bear on how a theologian writes, not insofar as it actually would change what he does, but it would actually change, it seems to me, the requirement that modern theology feels to tell the world that the world that I'm actually writing for is the modern world. And it seems to me that that is almost an obligation for modern theology. That's the first thing. The second thing is that it seems to me that that if you take seriously your notion of the world as it is constructed in community, face-to-face, speaker-hearer, then all of these sorts of things we're talking about, like resurrection, really have a function of the meaning of life within that world.
Mm-hmm.
And not simply the meaning. I mean, resurrection within the context of a kind of lifeless world, it, even if you bought it, would mean them. And so it seems to me that notion of world is with us to understand almost everything. And I wanted to pick up on one other thing I said. That is, when I was writing a piece, I finally went to Betty after I got it done, that the problem I said is that this reads like I was giving a speech rather than. And then, of course, I realized that that's the only way I can write.
Right, exactly.
And far from being a limitation, and the more that voice is there, the more real it is. And Plato actually addresses that, the story of that thing.
Yeah.
The danger of print.
We are.
As just comments, I think, boy, all this stuff is so interrelated and directly back to the method of theology, not just
comments. We have a lot, I'm sure, a lot more questions. The time is getting short, and Bill has a big day tomorrow, 3 more hours of this, and we want to preserve his strength as much as we can, and want you to get a good night's sleep. So I'm going to just take the privilege of the chair and call this all abruptly to a halt. And thank you for this.
And I thank you for exerting the privilege of the chair to accomplish that end. I'm going to go to the hospital.